This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter in The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. In the previous chapter, we learned that Perry decided that he needed extra help in supporting his client, so he called in a private detective, Paul Drake. Chapter 13. The big old-fashioned house in which Franklin B. Shore had reigned as a financial power was lighted from cellar to garret. Two police cars were parked in the driveway. Under the contagion of excitement, adjoining houses showed lighted windows, mostly in the upper stories, and these oblongs of light in a neighborhood which was otherwise wrapped in slumber and darkness held in themselves a certain portent of tragedy. Mason drove past his house twice, then parked his car on the opposite side of the street and said to Della Street, "I'll make a preliminary survey. Do you want to sit here in the car?" "Okay." "Keep your eyes open. If you see anything suspicious, strike a match and light a cigarette. Otherwise, don't smoke. When you strike the match, hold it for a second close to the windshield, then cup your hands and blow it up to the cigarette. It won't do any harm to let the first match go out and strike a second, just in case I'm where I don't get your first signal." "Are you going up to the house?" "Eventually. I want to snoop around the front yard first." "Want me to go with you when you do make the house call?" "I'll let you know. I want to check up here first. Notice that the window over on the north side of the house, the one on the ground floor, it's wide open and the curtains aren't drawn. I saw the light from a flashbulb on the inside of that room just now. It looks as though they were photographing the window. That's significant." Della Street settled down in the car. "I suppose Trag's already on the job in person?" "Oh, sure. And your client, Gerald Shore?" "May have walked right into the middle of things," Mason said. "I hope he has sense enough not to give them his alibi." "What is his alibi?" Della Street asked. "He was with us, I hope. I hope," she said. "I don't think we've ever finished an alibi for a client, have we?" "No, that's why I hope he keeps his mouth shut." "Wouldn't Trag accept your word?" "Trag might, but put yourself in the position of someone in a jury box. A lawyer comes into the court defending a man charged with one murder. Another murder gets linked up with him. He says, at the time, I was with my lawyer, and the lawyer who is defending him and his secretary get on the stand and glibly try to prove the alibi. Doesn't look very well, does it?" She shook her head. "Not to a jury, it wouldn't." "That is why the better lawyers withdraw from a case when they have to be a witness," Mason said. "You mean you'd withdraw if you had to make an alibi for sure?" "I wouldn't want to be both a witness and an attorney in a case. I could be a witness." "We'll talk it over later," Mason said, and buttoning his overcoat against the chill of the night wind, which was sweeping down from the northeast, walked diagonally across the street toward the lighted house. Della Street watched him through the windshield of the car, her eyes darting about, searching the shadows. As Mason neared the yard and started to cut across the strip of lawn, Della saw the motion of a shadow near the hedge. Mason had turned so that he was facing the window in the north. The shadow was moving toward him. Della Street hurriedly lit a match. Mason, with his back to her, didn't notice the signal. Della reached to the dashboard and switched the headlights on and off twice. Mason turned. Too late. Della Street, rolling down the window of the car, could hear the conversation. "Mr. Mason?" Only one who had been intimately associated with Perry Mason for years would have noticed anything unusual in his voice as he said, "Yes, this is Mr. Mason. Why?" The man moved forward. "Lieutenant Trag wants to see you. He said you'd probably be along and for me to keep an eye out for you." Mason's laugh was hearty. "My compliments to Lieutenant Drag. When do we see him?" "Now." "Where?" "Inside." Mason linked his arm through that of the officer. "It's a little chilly outside anyway. Care for a cigar?" "Don't mind if I do." They marched up the stairs and into the house. Della Street settled back against the cushions of the automobile. Lights in the hallway beat into the lawyer's eyes so that he squinted against the golden glare. A plainclothes officer, seated by the door, got to his feet. "Tell Trag Mr. Mason's here." The guard looked curiously at Mason and said, "Okay," and vanished. Mason's escort held a match to the cigar, tilted his hat back on his head. "We stay here. I don't think the lieutenant would like to have you rubbering around the house until he's ready to talk to you." Mason heard the sound of quick steps. Trag came through the door, which opened from the living room. "Well, well, Mason. Nice of you to call. I wanted to talk with you. Called your office, but you weren't there. I endeavored to anticipate your every wish," said Mason with mock formality. "That's very thoughtful of you." Lieutenant Trag turned, pushed his head through the door, called out to someone, "Close that bedroom door." He waited until the sound of the door slamming shut indicated that his order had been obeyed. "Come on in, Mason." Trag led the way into the living room, Mason's eyes by his, and this time noticing thoroughly he had adjusted to the light. He took in the significant details of the photographic clarity. Gerald Shore, apparently perfectly calm and composed, was sitting in an easy chair, his knees crossed, puffing placidly at his pipe. A plainclothes officer stood unobtrusively in the shadows, his hat brim pulled down so that his face was completely in the shadow. The ruddy tip of a lighted cigarette glowed and paled alternately as he smoked. A man whom Mason took to be Como, with a distinctly oriental cast of countenance, was seated within a few feet of the officer. That end of the long room was shadowed by a relatively dim illumination, but the end over toward the hallway leading to Matilda's bedroom and the hallway itself blazed with a brilliant light thrown by powerful floodlights and reflectors which were supported on metal stands. These lamps, quite evidently, had been used to give illumination for photographic purposes. The wires which led to them from the outlets in various parts of the living room and hall crisscrossed over the floor. The closed door in the end of the hall concealed the interior of the room beyond. The blazing floodlights standing just outside the door showed quite plainly that Lieutenant Trag had wanted photographs of the bedroom, and the sinister red stains on the hardwood floor by the door showed why. "Sit down, Mason," Trag said. "I don't want to take any unfair advantage of you. I've already asked for your cooperation in times in the past. I'm not doing that now because I'm in definitely a hostile position." "How so?" Mason asked. "Mr. Shore says you're his attorney. He isn't doing anything. I don't like that." "I don't blame you," Mason said. "And Trag," went on, "I don't propose to stand for it. When a man tries to conceal something from me in a murder case, I consider it an admission of guilt." Mason's nod was sympathetic. "I'm hoping," Trag said to Mason, "that you'll talk. It's going to be unfortunate for your client if you don't." Mason nodded to Gerald Shore, sat down in a chair by the table, and said, "Of course I'll talk, Trag. I'm always willing to talk." Trag drew up a chair. Shore removed the pipe from his mouth. "Lieutenant Trag has been asking me questions. I told him you were my lawyer." Trag said, "That doesn't prevent you from answering questions about an entirely different matter." "How do you know it's an entirely different matter?" Mason asked. "Because it must have occurred after he'd employed you." "I see." Short tamped the tobacco down in the bowl of the pipe with his finger and said, "It's an axiom of the profession, Lieutenant. A lawyer who seeks to advise himself has a fool for a client." Trag said, "The point is, Shore refuses to tell me where he was when this crime occurred." Mason said, "Suppose you tell me what crime you're talking about, Trag." Trag said, "All right, I'll tell you that. Helen Kendall was sitting on the Davenport talking with Jerry Templar, her, well, if she's not engaged to him, she ought to be. They heard a noise in Mrs. Shore's bedroom." "What sort of noise?" Mason asked, his eyes showing keen interest. "As though a bedside stand or something of the kind had been knocked over?" "By an intruder climbing in through the window on the north side," Mason asked. Trag hesitated for a moment, then said, "Well, yes. Go on." "Naturally, Helen Kendall was startled," Trag said, "as she knew that her aunt was not in the bedroom. After they both heard sounds that should have been Matilda Shore walking across the room, the thump-thump of a cane and the slightly dragging steps, it's significant that if Miss Kendall hadn't known that Mrs. Shore was in the hospital, she would not have paid any attention to the sounds, thinking that her aunt had accidentally overturned some object in getting out of bed to go to the bathroom. But since she knew Mrs. Shore was not in the house, they started to investigate. Mrs. Shore was in the hospital? Mason asked. Trag said, she was. I can vouch for that. Templar opened the door while he was fumbling for the light switch. Someone who was in the room shot him with a revolver. Two shots were fired. The first missed. The second struck him in the left side. Killed? Demanded Mason quickly. No. I understand his chances of recovery are about 50-50. The doctors are performing an emergency operation. This seems to be one of your more lurid nights, Trag, Mason said. Trag ignored him. They ought to have the bullet shortly if they have not already recovered it. I've got here, though, the bullet which missed him and which hit the woodwork just to the side of the door. It missed Helen Kendall's head by a scant inch or two. It's a .38 caliber slug, apparently fired from a conventional double-action, self-cocking revolver. I haven't as yet matched it up with the bullet which killed Henry Leach. But I won't be at all surprised if all three shots were fired from the same gun. That means, of course, they were fired by the same person. Mason drummed softly with the tips of his fingers on the arm of the chair. Interesting, he observed. Isn't it? Trag said acidly. Mason nodded. If we concede in advance that all three shots were fired from the same gun and that, therefore, they must have been fired by the same person, we can exclude Leach because he's dead. Matilda Shore, because she was in the hospital at the time, the last crime was committed. Gerald Shore, because he has a perfect alibi for the same period. Also Helen Kendall and Jerry Templar. Moreover, I'm quite capable of working out the theory of elimination, Trag interrupted. What I'm interested in is your statement that Gerald Shore has an alibi. Mason said, he has. Well, what is it? Mason smiled. You haven't told me the time the crime was committed. Then how do you know he has an alibi? Trag countered quickly. That's right, Mason said, smiling. I don't, do I? Now let's see. The person who entered the room knew that Mrs. Shore wasn't in the room, but didn't know that Helen Kendall knew it. How do you make that deduction? Trag asked interestingly. Mason said, because he tried to deceive Helen by impersonating Mrs. Shore, walking across the room just as Mrs. Shore would have done. That proves Gerald Shore couldn't have done it. Gerald knew that Helen knew her aunt was in the hospital, not in the house. Trag frowned. It was plain that Mason's reasoning impressed him and also upset some theory that he had formed. Suddenly, the guard at the other end of the room said, "This Jap's doing a lot of listening, Lieutenant. His ears are sticking out a foot." Trag turned his face, showing annoyance. "Get him out of here." Como bowed. Excuse me, please, he said with dignity. I am not Japanese. I am Korean. My sentiments for Japanese are not friendly. Get him out, Trag repeated. The guard clapped a hand on Como's shoulder. Come on, Skibby, he said. Out. Trag waited until Como had been escorted from the room to the kitchen. Then he turned to Mason. Mason, he said, I don't like your attitude, nor that of your client. Mason grinned. If we're going to play a game of truth, Lieutenant, it's my turn. I don't like the way you dragged me in here as though I was a second-story man, Trag said. And perhaps you won't like what I'm going to do now any better. When my men checked on the Castlegate Hotel, the clerk said that there were three of you in there when the letter was received. Four of you went up to the mountain. Now, why didn't one of your party want to go into the hotel? Just hold everything a moment. Trag got up, walked out to the telephone in the hallway, leaving the door open behind him. He dialed a number and after a moment said, The Castle Hotel? The night clerk? This is Lieutenant Trag. Homicide? That's right. What time did you come on duty last night? 6 o'clock. All right. Do you know the name Gerald Shore? Let me describe him. About 62 years old, rather distinguished looking, a high forehead, clean-cut profile, 5 feet 8 or 8 and a half, Weight 165 pounds, flowing gray hair which sweeps back from the high forehead, wearing a gray checked suit, a light blue shirt, and blue and red necktie with black pearl scarf pin. He was? When? Oh, I see. For how long? I'll be up and see you within the next half hour. In the meantime, don't talk with anyone about this. Trag slammed up the telephone receiver and came back to the stand where he could look from Gerald Shore to Perry Mason. I think I begin to see a very great light, he said. Perhaps, Mr. Shore, you will tell me why you went to the Castlegate Hotel early this evening and waited and waited and waited. Gerald Shore calmly removed the pipe from his mouth and pointed the stem toward Perry Mason. He's my lawyer. Trag nodded. His smile was triumphant. Okay, Jerry. He called to the guard in the hall. Mr. Mason has got to go. If you see him hanging around, remind him that he has an engagement elsewhere. Until we meet again, counselor. Then he held up his hand for attention. And I'm telling everyone here that as soon as Franklin Shore is found, I want him as a witness to testify before the grand jury. And you'll all kindly remember that. Mason turned without a word and started for the front door and opened it. Trag said to Gerald Shore, "This is going to be about your last chance to say something." Mason hesitated, listening for Shore's reply. "Have you got a match, Lieutenant?" Shore asked calmly. The guard bustled Mason out the front door. The door slammed shut. Another officer, evidently waiting to see that he left the grounds promptly, stepped up beside him. "I'll walk you to your car." "Oh, no need to. Oh, I'd better. No telling what might happen around here tonight. Wouldn't want anything to happen to you, Mr. Mason." Perry walked down the driveway, the officer marching at his side. Peering across the street, he saw only the vacant curb. There was no sign of an automobile nor of Della Street. For a moment only, the lawyer was puzzled. He hesitated just enough to throw the officer out of step with him. "What is it?" the officer asked. "Little kink in my leg," Mason said, walking toward the corner. "Say, Mr. Mason, your car's on the other side. You'd better..." "Where the hell is your car?" Mason said. "My chauffeur took it back to the office. I had an errand I wanted done." The officer looked at him suspiciously. "Where are you going now?" "I'm going to take a walk, a long walk, to get some air. Would you like to come along?" said the officer with feeling. "Hell no." Next week, we'll read Chapter 14, In the Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Garner. Our next reading comes from Special Paw Prints Edition, A Cat's Brain. And this article is Kindred Spirits, Understanding the Bond. Dogs were civilization's first pet, and it's clear why. Tens of thousands of years ago, humans were largely hunters, and dogs, with their powerful sense of smell, were speedy tracking allies. Even beyond their strong sniffers, dogs were used as pack animals and toted hunting groups' belongings to extend their range beyond the dwelling sites. Though felines can smell nearly as well as dogs, cats and their wild ancestors have always been solitary hunters, slowly motivated by hunger. Since they were largely useless on hunting expeditions, the domestication of cats trailed that of dogs by thousands of years. The cat-human bond wasn't needed by either side until humans started to settle down, till the earth and the store surplus crops, all while tightening wild cats' hunting grounds. This shift presented an opportunity for a delicate working arrangement. Cats needed a secure source of food, while humans sought out free pest control for the grain stores plagued by mice. Researchers have come to understand that cats' domestication was all but inviting themselves inside while being delighted with the abundance of easy prey in storehouses and in barns. Over time, as humans began to favor more docile cats, they started to create the dozens of breeds of house cats that now exist. There are now roughly 370 million pet cats around the world, and the previous working relationship has clearly tipped in the house cat's favor. On average, cat owners spend more than $900 a year to care for a pet, and modern felines are far more or less likely to be caught catching sun rays through an open window than catching mice in the backyard. benefits of the bond. The benefits of a cat companion extend far beyond home exterminator. Research has found that relationships between humans and cats can make both species happier and healthier. An Australian peer-reviewed study published in 2015 found that cat owners reported an overall higher quality of psychological health compared with non-cat owning participants. In one study from the State University of New York at Buffalo, researchers observed 120 married couples in their homes to see how they responded to stress and test whether cats were any of the help. While the heart rate and blood pressure were monitored, the couples were put through a series of stress-inducing tasks, such as things as subtracting 3 repeatedly from a 4-digit number, holding their hand in the ice water for 2 minutes, and the researchers found that before the stressful tasks began, the cat owner had a lowering resting heart rate, and blood pressure than people who didn't own any pets. And during the tests, the cat owners also had better results. They reported that they were more likely to feel challenged than threatened. Their heart rate and blood pressure were lower, and they even made fewer math errors. In general, cat owners also recovered faster from the tests. Other researchers have echoed the link between cat ownership and a healthy ticker. In a study published in the Journal of Vascular and Interventional Neurology, researchers noticed a link between cat ownership and a decreased risk of dying from heart attack or stroke. Acquisition of cats as domestic pets may represent a novel strategy for reducing the risk of cardiovascular diseases in high-risk individuals. Cats may also prevent allergies, according to a 2011 study published in the journal Clinical and Experimental Allergy. Adolescent participants who had been exposed to cats during their first year of life were less likely to develop pet allergies as a result. A 2017 study found that the cat exposure in early life decreases asthma risk among the highest risk individuals. Genotyping research was performed in 377 children from the at-risk Copenhagen prospective studies on asthma in childhood, and the study found a decreased risk for childhood pneumonia and bronchiolitis among cat-owning participants. How cats love us. With the myriad scientific literature highlighting the many ways dogs love humans, there's comparatively sparse understanding about how cats and humans interact. But the research that has been done challenges existing cat stereotypes. Common stereotypes include that cats are aloof, asocial, and do not prefer human interaction. But if cats are not social animals, why study their social behavior? These stereotypes have the potential to limit the type of work scientists choose to conduct. It is important to challenge these notions because the beliefs or expectations a person has for an animal may impact how they treat that animal, which in turn can impact that animal's behavior. These beliefs can be seen in how we treat our cats and dogs. Vitali led a study out of Oregon State University in 2019 that found that cats form attachments with their human owners that are similar to the bonds formed by children and dogs with their caretakers. It was also the first time that researchers had empirically demonstrated that cats display the same main attachment styles as babies and dogs. Vitali's research shows that cat sociability is equivalent to dogs. Both species have individuals who are highly social. Dogs are commonly taken outside of the home and socialized to novel dogs and people and places. However, many assume cats are not social or do not benefit from socialization, so they do not give their cats the same opportunities. Our work shows that cats are indeed able to be trained and can benefit from socialization activities. We don't want our beliefs to limit the abilities of our pets. Vitali herself has 4 cats, a gerbil, and an aquarium, and she recognizes the importance of social interaction with her own cats. She says that she tries to ensure that her cats receive enough individualized attention each day and that they have time to engage in social play every day. She trains her cats. One of my cats, Bo, serves as my trick cat and can engage in a number of behaviors like sit, spin, high jump, ring service, bell, and many others. Cats are one of the world's most popular companion animals. They form a variety of social relationships with people as companion animals, shelter animals, and cats living in free-roaming states outdoors. A better understanding of the cat-human bond can help us determine better ways of interacting with the animals, as well as managing cat population to help improve overall cat welfare. This article comes from Special Paw Print Edition, A Cat's Brain, How They Think, Learn, and Communicate. And this particular article is titled Kindred Spirits, Understanding the Bond. And it was written by Courtney Misfood Intreglia. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the articles, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.